Better work presentations are possible. They're called Canva presentations. You can supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. Just start with a prompt, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides in seconds. Or start with a stunning template and add images, graphics, charts, and data visualizations from their massive media library. You save time and wow your audience. There's a reason why Canva is used by 90% of the Fortune 500 companies. So nail your next work presentation with Canva presentations by heading to canva.com. Designed for work. This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank. Some things should be boring, like banking. Boring is safe and reliable. You don't want your bank to be surprising. Surprising is for podcasts about seemingly insignificant inventions that impact our lives, not banks. PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life. PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865. Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Inc., PNC Bank, National Association, member FDIC.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. There's a phrase from Shenzhen, China that goes, "Time is money, efficiency is life." And over the last 40 years, the city has wasted no time becoming one of the most productive manufacturing hubs in the world. But along with making 90% of the world's electronics, it's also a place that is known for producing lots of convincing high-end knockoffs.
Not just sneakers, but imitation Yeezys. Not just purses, but counterfeit Gucci clutches.
Producer Vivian Lai.
Shenzhen even has a mall that's famous for its faux versions of big designer brands. It's a popular destination for YouTubers to drop by and film clickbaity videos titled "China's Fake Shopping Malls" or "Shenzhen Fake Market Insanity."
What is up? Good morning. We are right now in Shenzhen, and we are on our way once again to the fake market here. But first, let's get a few drinks.
Hey guys, don't forget to smash that subscribe button.
But there's a small neighborhood within Shenzhen that will have you second-guessing the line between fake and authentic.
It's known for mass-producing copies of the most celebrated works of Western art. Monets, Manets, Matisses, all painted by hand, all painted quickly, and all painted in one place.
It's called Dafen Village.
I had heard about Dafen Village, and when I first heard about it, I thought, of course there's a village in China. I was completely uninterested because it seemed so stereotypical.
This is Winnie Wong. She's an art historian and author of the book Van Gogh on Demand, China and the Ready-Made.
I used to take a lot of people through Dafen Village. One time I was taking a woman from Hong Kong through it. And as we walked through, the first question she asked me was, which of these are the fakes? And I thought, well, that's actually a very complex question.
We typically think of the craft of oil painting as a slow, meticulous, even romantic process. But the pace is dramatically different in Dafen. At its height, 60% of the world's oil paintings were made in this 0.4 square kilometer village by Chinese workers.
This type of manufacturing is called trade painting. Trade painting is not necessarily art with a capital A. It doesn't command the same kind of respect because it's made quickly and cheaply in order to sell as generic decor.
There's a very good chance that you've been in the presence of a painting made in Dafen. Perhaps you passed one at the dentist's office or in the conference room of a Marriott in Orlando. You may have even hung one up in your home without even realizing it.
Dafen is a place that's been vilified, romanticized, and analyzed since it came into the world's collective consciousness specifically because of what it manufactures.
If you think about it, it's completely arbitrary. But it's arbitrary in that it's a product of Western culture, that oil painting means something different from a ceramic pot or an iPhone, right?
We can imagine the mechanical processes involved in mass producing something like a lamp or exercise equipment. But what happens in Dafen feels entirely different, simply because the objects being mass produced are oil paintings.
Prior to the 1980s, the city of Shenzhen was mostly farmland.
And Dafen was just an ordinary rural village, not really known for anything in particular, let alone art.
I have one photograph of it from probably 1970s. And it is, yeah, just two, three rows of houses, one taller, we call it diaolo, and a lot of fields. That's all.
But Dafan's fate was very quickly transformed by a monumental moment in modern Chinese history, the creation of the Shenzhen Special Economic Zone.
There's a legend about the founding of Shenzhen, that in 1979, Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping drew a circle on the map by the South China Sea and determined that Shenzhen would be the home of China's first special economic zone. It would be a controlled area where China could open up to the rest of the world and experiment with market capitalism by offering special tax benefits to encourage foreign investment.
It was a modern neoliberal fairy tale that was even celebrated in song. This song, actually, called Story of Spring. It depicts the moment when Shenzhen sprang forth from anonymity, mythically building a city that rose to the sky and mountains of gold, as if by magic.
But it was not. There are very good historical and strategic reasons to place a special economic zone there.
If you want to know more about SEZs, you should go back and listen to the previous episode of 99% Invisible, the one right before this one. It involves a little airport in Ireland. I can't explain it here. Just listen to it. Okay, carry on.
As Shenzhen rapidly transformed through the 1980s, businesses started moving there for the cheap real estate, inexpensive migrant labor, and low cost of living. Many of these businesses came from neighboring Hong Kong.
Among all the first enterprising business people to move into Shenzhen were Hong Kong businessmen, of course, because they were right there.
One of those early enterprising businessmen was a former painter named Huang Jiang.
According to the plaques in Dafan, in 1989, Huang Jiang traveled from Hong Kong and rented out a residential building in Dafan with intent to manufacture and export oil paintings.
Huang Jiang recruited a team of 20 painters and began churning out hand-painted copies of Picasso's, Van Gogh's, and Da Vinci's. Here he is in an interview explaining how he was able to divide the labor between many different painters.
I taught them to paint as if they were on an assembly line. Some painted the sky, some painted the mountains, and others painted trees.
When you divided the painting to different parts, it's easier for them to handle. Especially for wholesale, that really matters because otherwise you cannot finish the painting.
This is June Wang, associate professor in the Department of Public Policy at the City University of Hong Kong. Huang Jiang and other entrepreneurial painting bosses focused on copying famous works of Western art because any artist who had been dead for more than 50 years wasn't protected by Chinese copyright laws. But also, they were aiming to sell their products to businesses all over the world.
Huang Jiang matters at that time. In the initial period, because he has the connection to quite a lot of Hong Kong dealers.
All around Hong Kong, hotels, financial centers, and airports were being built. And those brand new buildings needed to be decorated with lots of cheap, nondescript art. But really, those connections to Hong Kong were important because that was the gateway to businesses in the West.
Dafan's oil paintings were sold and exported to hotels, real estate developers, and retailers like Kmart and Walmart. And painters were churning out wholesale orders just as quickly as the Western businesses were gobbling them up.
It's actually pretty common for factory towns in mainland China to develop around a single type of production. There are areas that specialize in manufacturing only buttons, or jeans, or violins. And in this case, Dafan developed around manufacturing oil paintings.
When people came to Dafan in the first phase, it was really, truly people with no education, like really people, rural people who had no outlet, but who had some aptitude. And maybe their parents or cousin or friend said, hey, you like painting. Why don't you come and try this?
If a person was looking for work and had a little bit of artistic ability, Dafan was the place to go.
By the late 1990s, Dafan had exported millions of artworks, and the streets were becoming packed with painters, people stretching canvases, art supplies.
Honestly, it's a little bit claustrophobic. You've never seen so many paintings.
This is Philip Tenari, director and CEO of the UCCA Center for Contemporary Art.
Streets and streets, you know, stores and stores that go on and go in, and yeah, there's just more than you could ever see.
and you could find all sorts of paintings in Dauphin. The most well-known were the replicas of famous works of Western art, the Mona Lisa, the Birth of Venus, etc. Then there was a smaller market for original creations by local artists.
You had a wide variety of different kinds of production going on there. Everything from a hotel decorator who would come in with an order for a few hundred canvases made to certain specs in terms of color and content.
You could also commission a painter to copy any image. So if you had a picture of, say, oh, I don't know, your boss singing karaoke at a staff retreat, you could actually email that photo to a painter in Dauphin, and they would send that image back to you as an oil painting on canvas.
Sorry, what was that?
Nothing.
It's sort of an earlier moment of e-commerce, but very primitive. But I think that was kind of an interesting way of looking at how images moved and were transformed, and this moment when they're transformed from digital into physical, and what that meant.
Winnie Wong spent a lot of time in Dauphin and actually apprenticed as a painter in a workshop. She found out that some artists are easier to copy than others.
The easiest paintings, then the lowest paid, were Van Gogh paintings.
Man, Van Gogh just can't catch a break.
And then I learned that there was a progression. You go from Van Gogh painting to Impressionism, and then from Impressionism eventually to sort of French academic painting.
And the hardest and most highly regarded style would be neoclassical paintings.
So let's say a David with like the coronation of Josephine would be like, you know, what you would paint to show that you're a really good painter.
Repetition, a strong network of workers, and efficiency is how Dauphin painters were able to fulfill large wholesale orders. Wong says that the average painter could produce 1 to 2 paintings a day, but experienced workers could churn out much more.
People would challenge themselves. One of my friends, he explained, he said, I didn't believe it too when I started, but I came to specialize in fruit paintings.
This particular friend was really competitive, so kept working at it until he could figure out some shortcuts to reduce a painting down to a few brush strokes.
And he said, you know, finally he reached the peak of 26 paintings a day. And he did it by using a specific set of brushes that he would, you know, tailor and in such a way that he could paint a grape with 2 stripes and an apple with 3 stripes, right? So he developed essentially his own kind of repetitive method, his own specialized tools.
Of course, not everyone was producing 26 paintings a day, but many painters could work very long and very tiring hours for not a lot of pay.
But Jun Wong told me that, especially in the early years, most painters in Dauphin came from rural farming backgrounds who didn't have a pathway to a career in the arts. Also, painting was a very different type of creative labor that pushed against stereotypes of what migrant workers could do.
Because of the discrimination, migrant workers are very tired about this image. They are either on the construction site or in the factories. So for many painter workers, they also take this as a success.
If you ask 1,000 different painters from Dauphin whether they're happy, you will probably get 1,000 different answers. Everyone has their own motivations for going there and what they ultimately want to do.
Dauphin painters probably would have continued quietly creating millions of the world's art replicas with little fanfare. But in the early 2000s, it happened to catch the attention of the government of Shenzhen.
So Shenzhen is trying to change its image and become more, you know, high-end. But Shenzhen doesn't really have that kind of a base, especially if you talk about culture. Shenzhen doesn't really have a long history. So for Chinese people, Shenzhen is a desert of culture.
Wong says that Shenzhen had quickly become an epicenter for science and technology. But when it came to culture and social cohesion, the local government felt like it was behind, mostly because the city was still so new.
The population of Shenzhen had exploded from around 59,000 people in 1980 to 7.7 million by the early 2000s, most of whom were migrant workers who came from all over the country with different local customs and even languages. And when it came to culture and the arts, leadership needed to start from scratch.
This wasn't just unique to Shenzhen. A lot of areas of mainland China had undergone incredibly rapid urbanization. And by the early 2000s, the Chinese government was beginning to understand how fundamental cultural and creative industries like the arts or music were to urban and economic development. Science and technology parks were great for job creation, but they believed that if you wanted to foster a strong society, you needed things like museums, opera houses, and arts districts.
In order to incubate creative development, the government decided to target interesting regions of the country, like Dafan, and promote them as cultural hubs.
This is something that happens pretty often in Chinese urban development. Dafan had distinguished itself as this place where painting happens. And then what's the next step? Can you make it into a cultural hub? Can you make it into an art district? Can you build a museum? Can you attract tourists? You know, where do you go from there?
However, the government wanted to lean away from the image of fake masterpieces because to them, replicating art was not the same thing as creating art. They didn't want Dafan to settle for being a copy village when it could be a center for original art and creativity.
So the goal was to transform Dafan from a copycat village into a legitimate artist district, starting with its urban development.
They did, you know, fix the sewage, you know, beautify the sidewalks. You know, they did do these things that one would expect a good government to do.
The local government paved the roads and updated housing. They also formed artist associations, hosted cultural fairs, and offered incentives to attract art school-educated artists in order to bolster Dafan's art cred.
The propaganda department even got involved to come up with more inventive ways to elevate Dafan's reputation.
They hired a novelist to write a novel. There was a movie. There were songs. They made a television series.
There were actually multiple television series based in Dafan, like this show called The Fate of Painting, about a woman who comes to a Dafan-like village to find her estranged father, but is confronted by secrets, romance, and art.
The local government even took pains to address concerns of copyright infringement in Dafan.
They handed out copyright law books. They held like sessions on copyright infringement, right? They were concerned about this narrative that they were copyright infringers and they wanted to promote creativity, originality.
But as Dafan's profile rose, it didn't just gain the attention of the local government or artists. It was also starting to catch the attention of the rest of the world.
Around the same time that Dafan was undergoing this government-led culture project, Western media outlets were beginning to catch wind of this small village in China that pumped out hand-painted replicas of Western works of art. The West had been buying these paintings for years, but most people were just now beginning to understand where they came from and who was making them.
In the beginning, the international coverage was the opposite of what leadership was going for. A lot of news coverage focused on the image of an army of factory workers slaving away to pump out counterfeit paintings into the art market.
There were headlines like, "Own original Chinese copies of real Western art," and "Van Gogh from the sweatshop."
There was a New York Times story early on, and I think it confirmed a lot of prejudices people had about China at that moment as a place where things were being knocked off and copied. And, you know, what's the highest level of knockoff and copying? It's forging art.
Here's Philip Tenari from the UCCA again.
This is the moment of fake DVDs and counterfeit products and IP theft. So it was, you know, also easy to come at it from a lens of here they are copying this person or that person in a kind of piratical way where it wasn't, I'm not sure that was essentially what was going on.
At the time, Dafan was being swept up into larger debates about China's place on the global stage. What was happening in Dafan was a complex intermingling of migrant labor, craft, local policy, and globalism. But it was reduced into yet another story about how the West was the source of authenticity and China was ripping it off. Ironically, Dafan painters were being criticized for fulfilling a market that was created by the very people who demanded these paintings.
Of course, art forgery can and does happen in China, but it also happens everywhere. Plus, no one believed that the $30 painting they ordered from Shenzhen was an original Gustav Klimt. These paintings were not intended to sit in a gallery or museum. They were meant to spruce up the wall of a conference room.
By 2008, Dafan had undergone its urban makeover, and it even formally changed its name to Dafan Oil Painting Village. but it was never quite able to shake its image as the copy capital of the world.
It is very successful, very well-known in terms of high concentration of painters. But at the same time, Dufeng is always haunted by this image of copying.
It might not have become the bastion for, quote, original art, but the streets were cleaner, there was a lot more creative energy in the air, and the industry was booming. At least it was until...
This is going to be one of the watershed days in financial markets history.
It was a manic Monday in the financial markets. The Dow tumbled more than 500 points after two pillars of the street tumbled over the weekend.
In 2008, the global financial crisis rocked Wall Street and reverberated throughout the rest of the world, even reaching the small painting village of Dafen.
Before 2008, around 80% of the paintings made in Dafen were exported to the West. But the financial crisis had a severe impact on real estate development all over the world. Fewer construction projects meant that there were fewer blank walls that required cheap, unobjectionable decoration. Sales in Dafen plummeted by 50%.
You know, by 2015, it was very, very quiet in Dafen. Meaning there was a lot less business.
But even though business dropped a lot for Dafen, it didn't disappear completely. With the Chinese real estate boom and with a rising middle class within the country, Dafen had a new Chinese market to tap into, which meant that there were different artistic styles to cater to.
I know a while back the famous Van Gogh and the Mona Lisa, and those used to be popular. That's not so popular anymore.
Just a few customers buy these kind of paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the customers buy modern art. Mm-hmm. And are very, very popular, very beautiful images.
This is Chris Scher. He's the owner of a painting company called Shenzhen Melga Art that's been based in Dafen since 2017. He says that those replicas of classical Western art that put Dafen on the map aren't really in vogue anymore. His buyers want modern, abstract, and original paintings.
In recent years, things have been more challenging in Dafen. Business never fully recovered after the 2008 financial crisis, and a lot of painters and bosses have moved out of the area because gentrification made it a less affordable place to live.
You know, in Shenzhen area, the factory rent, you know, very expensive.
Yeah.
The cost is very expensive.
The internet has made it possible to work from anywhere, so people have been moving to places with lower costs of living. There isn't as much reason to have a centralized painting industry anymore.
The stores in Dafen Village, their business become worse and worse.
Coming into reporting this, I thought that the type of labor that was happening in Dafen was wholly different from fine art. But I'm not so sure anymore. The truth is that the distinction between mass production and individual artistry has always been blurry. Artists all over the world, like Jeff Koons, have quietly used laborers and fabricators in order to execute their grand ideas. Dafen painters actually let us in on that process and show us that relationship in an unambiguous way.
You could look at Damien Hirst or Koons and say, well, that's what they're doing. You know, or go back to Warhol and the factory, where really you're overseeing a project. You're sort of the architect of the project, but the labor is being done by multiple people or in multiple places or in multiple stages.
This is Eddie Cola. He's a mixed media artist who spoke to me from beautiful, noisy East Oakland, California.
A lot of notable artists have actually used Dafen painters, sort of like ghostwriters. They come up with the concept and then outsource the labor to Dafen in order to execute their ideas because it's efficient.
And Eddie thinks that there's actually something creative and undervalued happening in the mass manufacturing of oil paintings at places like Dafen. He decided to blur the line between production and art even further by incorporating the Dafen copying process into his artwork.
I mean, part of the reason I want to go back to Dafen is because there's so many possibilities about what you could do as an artist.
Eddie visited Dafen back in 2018 while he was doing an artist residency based in Shenzhen. And while he was there, he decided to conduct a bit of an artistic experiment. He had a graphic that he had designed. It was an image of a woman staring straight forward, sort of like in a passport photo. Aside from some red text running down the sides, it's a pretty monochromatic image, kind of like something from an edgy graphic novel. He chose a Dafen painter randomly and asked him to copy the graphic as an oil painting. About a week later, he got a message that the painting was ready. Then he repeated the process, asking another painter to make a copy of that copy.
I went to pick it up and then just basically walked 20 or 30 feet down the street and handed the second painter the first copy. I said, can you copy this? And he's like, sure.
He did this every week for 7 weeks, each time bringing the newest copy of the image, until he was left with six different paintings that all built upon the last version.
And so the whole point of the process was, how does the idea of copying something over and over again change? And it does. Like, the last painting compared to the original painting are completely different.
By the sixth painting, the image had changed in a ton of obvious and beautiful ways. While the first painting was muted and somber, the sixth painting was exploding with color. The subject of the painting even looks like a different person.
One thing that's overlooked about oil paintings produced in Dafen is that they're not exact copies. Every painting is actually unique because it is done by hand. We just tend to focus on the similarities and not the differences.
Eddie sees this project as a reflection of Greater Shenzhen, a place that's been criticized by the West for copycat culture, when in fact, copying is an essential part of the artistic process, or really any learning process for that matter. In his interpretation, the, quote, real art can't exist without the, quote, fake art.
We always start copying. In fact, I mean, that's how all knowledge really works. If you learn to play an instrument, they teach you how to play existing songs. They don't say, well, write an original composition. And so I think that's exactly the way all things evolve.
Dafen labor has been used in a lot of different ways.
Wait, hold on a second.
When the West demanded affordable masterpieces, Dafen painters made them. When China wanted original works of art, Dafen created them. When professional artists needed skilled labor, Dafen supplied it.
Okay, so I have this package from China. It's about 2.5 feet by 1.5 feet. To Roman Mars.
And when I reached out to a painting company in Dafen and asked them to create something truly absurd.
This is a picture of me holding a microphone.
Which was an oil painting of my boss doing karaoke at a staff retreat. They really delivered. And honestly, it was worth every penny.
Now that is art right there. Vivian comes back to tell me about a curious byproduct of China's rapid urbanization, villages in the middle of the city. After this. When was the last time you had an oinks and giggles guarantee? Maybe you had a giggles guarantee, maybe you had an oinks guarantee, but oinks and giggles? That's reserved for one thing only, the Peppa Pig Caravan Playset. If you're a parent, you're probably familiar with Peppa Pig, that delightful cartoon pig from the long-running children's series. Peppa inspires people of all ages to jump through life and its muddy puddles with enthusiasm. You can now bring Peppa into your home in physical form with the Peppa Pig Caravan Playset. Instead of just seeing her on the screen, your kids can take Peppa into the home, have some imaginative play, open-ended, creative. It's good for your brain. It's good for your soul. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence since 2004. Peppa Pig is a trademark of Hasbro, created by Mark Baker and Neville Astley. Whether you're a family vacation traveler, a business tripper, or a long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels features locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. That's what I like. I like to be within walking distance of all the stuff. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants.
And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. With so many hotel brands, Choice Hotels allows you to prioritize what you need. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. Arkel believes in delightful design for every home, and thanks to their online-only model, they have some really delightful prices, too. Everyone who's listened to this show for years knows how in the bag I am for Arkel furniture. I love it. I have a ton of it in my home. But our sound engineer, Martin Gonzalez, just redid his whole living room with Arkel. He sent me a picture, and it was almost comical how much Arkel furniture he stuffed into his Brooklyn apartment. So I'm going to let him tell you what he thinks.
I'm sitting here enjoying my brand new Arkel living room set. I replaced my junky, free and Craigslisted furniture with a very nice set from the Senni collection. I got a sofa, love seat, and chair, all in matching volcanic gray. Were delivered right to my door. All I did was pop open the boxes and screw some legs on. I am so much more excited to have people over now that I'm not embarrassed of my furniture. I did, in fact, use this offer code that Rowan is about to tell you.
Arkel is offering our listeners $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim, visit arkel.com/99, and the discount will automatically be applied at checkout. That's arkel.com/99 for $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. So my wife and I wanted to take a couple of the kids to see Taylor Swift in concert. We signed in with pre-sale fan codes and logged in on separate devices, each going after a different venue. And then we got bounced out of different venues. And then she managed to get tickets in Minneapolis. So when you want the best, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you're hiring for your business. You want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/99. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/99. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/99. ZipRecruiter. The smartest way to hire.
So I'm back with Vivian Light. Hey, Vivian.
Hey, Roman. How are you doing? How's the painting? Where'd you put it?
It is in the closet. We have this walk-in closet. It's on Joy's side. So like when she's getting ready in the morning, there's just like this oil painting of me like crooning at her, you know? And it's this kind of funny inside joke for us. But every once in a while, if somebody's like, I don't know, coming by and they haven't been to the house because people haven't been to the house very much.
Yeah.
You know, so you give them a tour or whatever. And then you realize that there's this oil painting of your own face, like in the closet. And they kind of walk away.
Yeah. Like, oh, man, this Roman's really entered his megalomaniac phase, I guess. He's got this oil painting of his face.
Yeah. It freaks out the kids a little bit. It has a very fun effect on the household. I'm very, very happy with it. So I'm assuming you don't want to just talk about the oil painting of my face in the house. there's something that you researched that didn't make it into the story.
Yes, yes. You monsters actually cut it out of the script. but I really wanted to talk about urban villages, this thing called urban villages, because Dauphin is sort of both a good and a bad example of one.
So what exactly is an urban village?
Yeah, so they're this very fascinating urban design phenomenon that came out of the rapid development of Shenzhen. So this also happens outside of Shenzhen, but I'm just going to focus there because we're already there.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But, if you were to look at Shenzhen today, it is like a gigantic megacity full of towering skyscrapers, technology parks, and these big open city blocks that were, centrally planned and are managed by the government. So
for the most part, it looks like this cohesive, you know, even futuristic metropolis. I've actually dropped a photo below to give you an idea of what it looks like from.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing, like multicolored, fancy glass. It looks like a future city.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, when I say that it's cohesive for the most part, it's because scattered throughout the city are these small pockets of neighborhoods that actually disrupt the urban fabric of modern Shenzhen in this really interesting way. And these neighborhoods are the urban villages.
So what do you mean by disrupt? Like, what do they look like?
So they're essentially these blocks within the city that developed entirely differently from the rest of centrally planned Shenzhen. Like I mentioned that most of the city is composed of giant steel and glass skyscrapers that seem super modern with these wide streets. But urban villages are these incredibly dense neighborhoods packed with multi-story apartment buildings divided by very narrow alleyways. And you can instantly tell that the same building codes do not apply in these places as the rest of Shenzhen because the apartment buildings, they're way smaller, like 3 to 10 stories tall, but they're just so densely built next to each other. Like, they're so densely packed that they're actually called handshake buildings because supposedly you could reach your arm out the window and shake the hand of the person in the next building.
Whoa. Okay. You're talking very, very close.
Yes, very, yeah. Very close together. So these apartments are also mixed use, so people might live in the floors above. And then down below, there's like, it's like bustling with markets and shops and restaurants and schools. And I actually have another picture of the meeting point between an urban village and the rest of the city.
Okay, so we're looking at a sort of top-down view of, mm-hmm. you know, buildings surrounding, like tall buildings surrounding, and then a real, like, mishmash, hodgepodge of buildings at different angles and different heights. And it really is very, very different. It's just like this informal enclave, like enveloped by, you know, square angle rest of the city. So you mentioned that the building codes are different. I mean, are they just regulated completely differently than the rest of Shenzhen?
Yeah. So while most of Shenzhen is managed by the government, these urban villages are owned and managed by village collectives, which is why, you know, the same building codes don't apply to them and why their development almost looks improvisational compared to the rest of the city.
Huh. So if the rest of Shenzhen was so meticulously planned, how did urban villages, you know, come about?
If you were to go back to the creation of the Shenzhen Special Economic Zone in 1980, you know, Shenzhen was chosen as the location for a number of reasons, but a key reason was because it was this very rural area with a lot of farmland prior to the 1980s. So it was much more sparsely populated, but there were still, you know, tens of thousands of people who lived there prior to the SEZ. These are people that we call, you know, original villagers. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting because people tend to hype up the idea that Shenzhen was built from nothing and it was this blank slate prior to the Shenzhen SEZ, and, you know, it sprang forth because of, you know, capitalism or whatever. But, yeah. You know, the presence of the original villagers actually had this huge impact on, you know, the development of the SEZ.
In what way did they have an impact?
When Shenzhen was selected as the location of the first SEZ, the government bought up all of that vast uninhabited farmland, but it did not purchase the plots of land that the original villagers actually built their homes on, meaning the actual village community land where the houses were.
Huh. Well, why not? It seems like that's a thing you do.
Yeah. Like, apparently it was just, like, too expensive to buy that land and relocate the actual people. So the government just let them stay and manage those plots of lands themselves and then built the rest of Shenzhen around these villages. So these villages literally became surrounded by skyscrapers.
Oh, okay. So they really predate everything and they just built around them, which is actually like, I don't know, it's kind of a good sign. They didn't just move them and bulldoze them. And so much of world history is built on that premise that it's kind of a nice, I don't know, change of pace.
Yeah, it's shockingly nice, surprisingly nice, just given history.
Yeah. So how did these urban villages grow to what they look like today? Because I can't imagine the original houses and villages that used to occupy the space looked like this. I mean, they look like urbanized areas. They just look like a different kind of urbanization than the skyscrapers around them.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, The original villagers, they didn't have this farmland to make a living off anymore after the creation of the SEZ, but there was this huge opportunity because they had their hands on this prime real estate that was in the middle of a very rapidly growing city. So what the original villagers ended up doing is they formed village collectives to manage the land, and then they tore down their houses that were there and then constructed these really dense multi-story apartment buildings to rent out to, like, the millions of new migrants that were flocking to Shenzhen for job opportunities.
Wow. So they really just bought into the whole, like, we're going to become a capitalist economy, right?
Yeah, they just leaned right into it.
Okay. Good. Good for them.
Yeah, but, like, the remarkable thing about urban villages is that, you know, spatially, they only make up a small part of the city, but by the year 2000, they housed essentially half of the population of Shenzhen.
Oh, my God, that doesn't compute from the pictures I see.
Yeah.
That's really, really insane. So these are really dense. Like, people are really packed on top of each other. And it makes it seem like also that those buildings surrounding these urban villages are not very dense. Like, they don't have enough housing for people.
Yeah, exactly. So urban villages basically became some of the only affordable housing options for a lot of migrant workers in Shenzhen. So, you know, for a lot of new low-income residents, you have, like, students, restaurant workers, construction workers, factory workers, basically blue-collar workers. Urban villages are, you know, the first stops when trying to find housing in Shenzhen because it's a very expensive city. And because you could find all of these different types of people and different types of shops and resources condensed into one small area, urban villages are, you know, full of life and really have become the center of a lot of culture.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, nothing is more dead than some dumb business district with tall buildings,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, earlier when I said that Dafen is a good and a bad example of an urban village, you know, it's a good example because it's a similarly dense multi-use neighborhood that developed in this very different way from the rest of Shenzhen. But it's also a bad example because Dafen was a place that was given a lot of special treatment and attention by the government because it already had this flourishing painting industry. So Dafen was allocated money to modernize its infrastructure, but urban villages on the whole are not places that get a lot of respect.
And what do you mean by that?
So because these are spaces that are accessible to the poor, urban villages are often associated with, you know, overcrowding, shoddy construction. They're also linked with drug use and seen as dangerous areas. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's been debated how much of that reputation is just classism. Mm-hmm. So urban villages, especially in the last couple decades, have been targeted for, quote, urban renewal. And a lot of them have been torn down and redeveloped into more modern housing that more closely fits into that master plan for the rest of the city. But when urban villages get demolished, like, hundreds of thousands of people get displaced from their homes.
Yeah. I definitely can recognize that maybe urban villages have their problems, but, you know, not having affordable housing in the center of a large city is a problem that all cities seem to have. Mm-hmm. Like, they just seem to push low-wage workers that work in the city and serve people's needs further and further away and have to commute. And it just makes life harder for the people that we rely on, these people that, you know, we call essential workers at this point because of the pandemic. It's really awful to see that happen everywhere.
Yeah, that's totally right. And, you know, I think it's really important in the case of urban villages, it's really important to understand how important they've been to Shenzhen's success. I spoke with a professor of architecture and urban design named Zhuan Du, who actually has written extensively about Shenzhen. And, you know, she said that if you were to think about it from an ecological point of view, she compared urban villages to the wetlands of the city because they've provided all of this overlooked support to, you know, its overall health and development.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, these interstitial places where people have a little bit more freedom to solve problems and create the spaces that they need to live and become like little places to experiment. They're exactly like, you know, creating a healthy ecology with lots of different, you know, like niches being fulfilled and represented. I mean, not everyone can live in a gleaming downtown skyscraper.
Yeah. Yeah,
we
totally.
Know that.
Yes. I know that firsthand.
Well, this is fascinating stuff. I mean, I'm so intrigued by these places. They're very cinematic, you know, and I think they are a little odd to us, you know, in different ways, but they serve this vital purpose of figuring out like how people actually need to live. And it's important to pay attention to what services they provide, but it's a fascinating space, and it's, I'd love to hear more about them. I can't believe we, you know, us monsters told you not to talk about it.
Peace. See, I knew it.
No, it's super fascinating stuff. Well, thanks for bringing this little extra information to us. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you for letting me rant about it.
99% Invisible was produced this week by Vivian Lay, edited by Emmett Fitzgerald, mix and tech production by Martin Gonzalez, fact-checking by Graham Haysha, music by our director of sound, Swan Riau, with additional music by Jenny Conley-Drizos, John Neufeld, and Nate Query. Delaney Hall is the executive producer, Kurt Kohlstedt is the digital director. The rest of the team includes Christopher Johnson, Lashma Dawn, Joe Rosenberg, Chris Berube, Jason DeLeon, Sophia Klatsker, and me, Roman Mars. Special thanks this week to Lo Zui and Juan Du, whose interviews did not make it into the piece, but if you want to read more about the complexities of Shenzhen's special economic zone, Juan wrote a great book about it called The Shenzhen Experiment, The Story of China's Instant City. You should check it out. We are part of the Stitcher and SiriusXM podcast family, now headquartered 6 blocks north in the Pandora building, in beautiful Uptown, Oakland, California. You can find the show and join discussions about the show on Facebook. You can tweet me at Roman Mars and the show at 99pi.org. We're on Instagram and Reddit too. You can find links to other Stitcher shows I love, as well as every past episode of 99pi, and also pictures of that creepy oil painting that Viv had commissioned of my face at 99pi.org.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.